Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Conspire a Theory. I have with me Steve Stockton, researcher, writer, and all around good guy. Say hello to the kids, Steve.
Hi everybody. Thanks for having me on, Christopher. Glad to be here.
Now, I've been poking through some of your stories, and they're all scary stories, of course, so I can only read them during the daylight hours. So I can only read like your book half during the day. But hopefully we'll get back and we'll talk about some stuff, because I mean, the way that current events are going right now in the podcast sphere, people are either, you know, it's either Ruth Bader Ginsburg or everyone's had debating over cuties or just all this stuff. And we're just going to take a break from that, and we're going to get back into spooky. We're going to talk about some stories, some cryptids, some little research here and there. And we're going to basically, you know, just some general and just get to know you, because this is your first time here. And I've heard you on various shows. I think my first exposure to you was with Cisco Murdoch, who's been a regular on this show. She's been on here numerous times. I know I've had her on like officially twice, but I think one of the shows we went on for so long, I had to cut it into two parts.
Yeah,
because she is a talker.
Yeah, she's a good storyteller, stellar teller, as we like to say. I don't know how many episodes of hers I've been on, because I co-host with her sometimes on Journey Through the Gate.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, she's an amazing lady.
Yeah. You also co-wrote a book with her. Is that right?
Yeah, we did. We're All Children in the Wilderness of the Afterlife, a guided tour through a haunted life. It's really her stories. I'd been after her for a while. She'd tell me all these fantastic stories. First time we ever spoke on the phone, Soraya Askath from Where'd the Road Go was the one that put us together. And we talked for over 6 hours, just swapping tales back and forth. And I'm like, Cisco, you got to write these down. You got to write a book. Do what I did. You know, that's what I did. I told other people's stories that I'd collected over the years. And finally, after picking at her long enough, she said, okay, I'm going to do it, but you're coming with me. So I agreed to kind of go along behind her. And at the end of each chapter, I would write a little anecdotal story or color commentary, if you will. And it turned out great. I really reined myself in, because her writing was so good and the stories were so exceptional. I didn't want to overshadow or take away from that. But it's an excellent book.
Yeah. I'll say this much. She really loves her long titles. Mm-hmm. Children of the Book and the Gatekeeper of the Journey. And it's just sometimes I'll like try to like recite one of her podcasts, and I end up
trip over the title of the book, but I think I got it right today.
And then you just have to say, you know, Cisco Murdoch Show. Then everybody's like, oh, okay. Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. But yeah, mm-hmm. that's where I first heard you. And then I think I heard you on several episodes with Shannon LeGros from Into the Fray. Her show is fantastic. I've tried to get on her show.
I don't know how many times I've been on there. I did hold the record. I don't know if that still stands or not, but, we've got Cisco and I do an annual Halloween show with her. We're going to be recording that soon. So got that to look forward to. But I think I've been on there probably 5 or 6 times. And then I've been on with Soraya, Where'd the Road Go? I've been on there several times too. Cisco with me a couple of times. We had a really unique occurrence on there where something happened to Soraya's equipment, and we couldn't hear him. He could hear us, but the computer was frozen, but it was still recording. So we went on, and I think we ended up with about a 3-hour episode, and it took us a while before we even realized he wasn't there anymore. But he just let it roll and let us talk, and it turned out great. But that happens sometimes. It's happened to both Cisco and I together, and then I've experienced it alone. Sometimes when we do these shows, weird things will happen with the equipment. I get emails saying, oh, I was listening to you, and the glass bowl full of fruit on my coffee table exploded, or all my paintings fell off the wall, or there was a knock at the door and nobody was there. So who knows?
I don't know if you've heard of this, but I got to tell you about the first time me and Cisco started talking. Okay. And this goes into that something crazy happening. We started talking about the black eyed kids and the phenomena. And I was just going over the basics with her. And then my fire alarm just went off. Just out of nowhere. I had to, you know, stop everything, go up there and grab it. And it was just so crazy, so out of character. Absolutely nothing wrong with it. It just went off.
Oh, yeah. That's another one. I actually had a Black Eyed Kids encounter back in the 90s.
Tell me.
Reticent to talk about it because every time I do, something happens.
Hang on. Let me check my equipment. Let me make sure that the fire alarms, that the ladder's in place in case I got to rip it off.
But,
we'll weather the storm.
The first time I ever told it publicly was on, Art Bell's show. Art was sick that night, but Heather Wade, his producer, was running the show. And she had me on as a guest, and she and I talk, you know, in real life apart from the show, and she knew about it, and she kind of goaded me into telling it, and I'd never really planned to tell it publicly, but I went ahead and told it, and that night, actually it was in the morning, about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning after I'd been on the show, there was a knock at the front door, and I've got cameras. I've got security cameras. I've got perimeter alarms, motion detectors. None of that went off. There was a knock at the door and then a scream, and it sounded like whatever was screaming on the porch came into the house, went all the way through the house and out the back door. Ooh. And first I thought maybe my daughter was living with me at the time, and I thought maybe something happened to her. And I jumped up and ran into her room. She's sound asleep. And I'm like, you didn't hear that? And she's like, no, but I told you not to talk about those Black Eyed Kids. That's what you get. And, I've told it 2 or 3 other times, and
well, what is the gist of the encounter? Just the bare bones.
Yeah, it was in East Tennessee, that's Knoxville in particular, where I was living at the time, and I had a day job as network administrator for a medical group that had 35 remote medical offices that we ran the day to day stuff for, and let the doctors worry about practicing medicine. We kept the practice going, and I was also moonlighting as just a network gun for hire. I taught myself computer work. And just up the street, there was a comprehensive breast center. And they were going from the old networks where dumb terminals to where everybody had a PC at their desk. So I was running Cat5 cable and putting in routers and things like that for them and going in after hours and doing it. And I was finishing up about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I came out, and this is in an industrial area. There's no houses or anything around there. It's businesses and doctor's offices and warehouses and things like that. And notice at the edge of the parking lot, my car is the only one there. Mm. There are two little girls sitting on the curb.
Oh. And,
wearing dark clothing, hoodies with the hoods pulled up. And I thought, you know, well, that's weird. What are kids doing out here? So I'm trying to get my stuff in my car. Hmm. I was driving a little Mazda Miata at the time, and the trunk on a Miata is not much bigger than the glove box on some cars. So it was like playing Tetris, trying to get all my tools and cables and everything in there. And I look over, I notice they've stood up, and I'm still trying to get my stuff in there. And now I'm kind of getting creeped out because every time I look over, they've gotten a little bit closer. And I never actually saw them walk, and I assume that they walked when I wasn't looking. But a little bit closer, a little bit closer, and the taller one of the two, I would say, I'm guessing, probably around 12 years old. The shorter one, I would guess, around 10. The taller one of the two started talking. She wasn't talking to me. It was more at me or about me to the shorter one. And she was saying, he'll let us in the car. He'll have to let us in. He won't leave us here. It's night. It's cold. And just on and on, nonstop. I mean, it was like a litany. It was just jabber, 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 jabber. There was no pause, no break, no breath, anything. And by now, I'm, you know, all the hairs are standing up on the back of my neck. Mm. And the next time I looked up, they're right under a streetlight. And they're within, oh, maybe 10 yards on me now. And once they're under the streetlight, I could see their faces. And they had either no eyes or the blackest eyes I've ever seen. It looked like coal, or it was beyond black where their eyes should have been. And that just
like a void.
Yeah. Okay. And I just got that whole fight or flight thing. I finally got everything in my car, jumped in the car. I'd fumbled with the door handle. I'd left the top down, just jumped over the door into the seat. And, you know, first of all, 2 o'clock in the morning, two kids, I'm not going to put them in a two-seater car and tool around at 2 o'clock in the morning. I call somebody for you or something like that. but the one still talking nonstop. And by the time I got in the car, got it started, they were right up to the edge of the door. And I was so frightened, I put the car in gear, hit the gas, jumped over the little curb, went down through the lawn of the building and out onto the road that way. At the time, I had a girlfriend that only lived a couple miles away, and I planned on spending the night over here so I could be back at my regular job the next morning. I only had about 6 hours before I had to be there. But instead, when I left, I went the other direction and drove to my parents' house in Oak Ridge, which was about 20 miles or so away. And the whole way there, there's a highway there, a connector that connects Oak Ridge with the airport and I-40 interstate called Pilsippi Parkway. All the way down Pilsippi Parkway, I'm doing like 90 and 100 miles an hour.
Hmm.
And I keep looking back, like over my shoulder, like I'm expecting to see them hanging onto the spoiler or run along beside the car or like they're going to appear in the seat or something. It was just such an irrational, insane fear of these two little girls. You know, looking back, it sounds ridiculous. But at the time, it was, I mean, it wasn't even fight or flight. It was just flight, pure flight. That's probably the most I've ever been scared. There's been a couple other instances. I had something that I couldn't see chase me in the woods once. And then another friend and I saw something that later on we came to think may have been a skinwalker or something like that. But the two little girls are the scariest thing I've ever encountered as far as the way I reacted to it.
Hmm. Yeah, well, that is quite a chilling thing.
And now that I've talked about it, I'll see if something strange happens. Usually every time I've heard knocks at the door, I've heard the doorbell ring and things like that after I talk about it. So after this episode airs, I'll let you know if anything weird goes on or if anything happens today after we've recorded.
Let's probably leave that on the shelf for right now. Now you've talked about a little bit. We've talked about your book with Cisco. Now, aside from the books, you also do a lot of YouTube recording. You do a lot of voice work for YouTube.
Yeah, I've got several different channels that I host or that I narrate for, and I do voiceovers and things. The main one is Missing Persons and Mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
And just like the title says, the main focus there is missing persons cases, 411 type stuff, if you're familiar with David Politis' work. It's that kind of stories. And then the mysteries part of that name, we delve into a little bit of everything there. Cryptids and Hat Man, Glimmer Man, Shadow People, and got a really active audience there. Got tons of subscriber stories. Those are some of our most popular videos of the stories that have been sent in there.
Hmm.
And then I have 13 Past Midnight, which is my personal channel. That's me narrating some of the stories from my books, among other things. There's a little bit of fiction on there by request, but it's mainly stuff I've written or stuff that people have asked me to narrate.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also do a new channel, Monster Madness, which is true cryptid encounters. We just released our sixth or seventh episode, I believe, today, the Tennessee Wild Man. So we cover everything on there. We've had Dover Demon, Flatwoods Monster, Kelly Hopkinsville encounter, nice mixed bag of cryptids over there.
Sounds like you've got like a finger in every pie. Quite a
you wouldn't believe. And I've got stuff going on in the background too. I write all the time. I do this full time, the writing and the voiceover work. And my usual day, I write 4 hours a day, I record for 4 hours, and I read for 4 hours.
That is a full day.
That's my work day. Good work if you can get it, I guess. Beats working for a living, beats punching the clock.
Now, before, you were also in the field for quite some time, if I recall. You've done some research and investigation yourself as well. Could you give us a little briefing on that?
Sure. Started out, I got into UFOs as a child and followed that through the 70s. And then that kind of led into other things. And then in the 80s, I was part of a group in East Tennessee called the Southeastern Paranormal Study Organization. And this was decades before, you know, that was the thing to do. Now everybody and their brother has a group, it seems like. And to me, that's good. I think we're seeing a renaissance or a new golden age of the paranormal where there are people out gathering evidence and getting EVPs and things. But we were doing stuff like that back in the 80s, just some local stuff there in the Southeast. And visited haunted locations. We didn't have all the tech equipment and things then. We had just regular film cameras, although we did use infrared film sometimes. and just the little, like the Sony micro cassette recorders to try to capture EVPs and things. But it was a lot of fun, and it's one of those things that I think if you do it long enough, you're going to get some evidence, but then kind of what do you do with it? You know, that's the thing. To me, the thrill's in the chase. I've found through my years of researching and investigating and stuff that I'm not really looking for answers. I find more questions, and that's what keeps me going. I mean, if we had answers to all this stuff, what would be the fun in that?
Well, I mean, it's sometimes when you're chasing for something, you know, we all want we all want the payoff. That's for sure.
That's true. I understand that. But to me, even if I don't get it, the fun is in the chase for me. The thrill is in the chase. I love collecting other people's stories and going to places, not so much as an investigator or even a researcher, but more of a legend tripper. As a storyteller, I like to go and visit these places where things have happened. And the majority of the story, especially in the first book, I've been to all those places. And then actually that's two books combined. Originally it was Strange Things in the Woods and More Strange Things in the Woods. And then I went with a traditional publisher back in April, and they combined both those into one volume. So now it's just Strange Things in the Wood, and that's the first two books. And then My Strange World came about. I would go on shows much as this one, and invariably the host, or if it was a radio show, people calling in would say, well, those are other people's stories. What experiences have you had? And I would tell one story or another. And then I thought one day, you know, I've probably got enough to make a small book. And I sat and wrote them down. I had enough to fill a book and some besides. And that's where My Strange World came from. Those are all personal experiences that have happened to me.
That is interesting. The investigation, I've dabbled in investigation myself before I even got into the, I guess, the broader world of paranormal stuff. I think at the time, all there was ghost hunting. And I tried it out, went with like a local group of people that I knew and all that stuff. And it was so boring. And there we had, because it was a large group and it was at an established haunted place. It was, not only was it boring, but there was also a ton of weirdos, you know. So, and it's, you know, I mean, not trying to sound completely disparaging, but for some people, they click with it really well. With me, however, it didn't quite register as, you know, I mean, I enjoy stepping into this world, but maybe not through this venue. And it sounds like you sort of had that sort of thing where that aspect didn't quite resonate with you.
Yeah, it's one of those things. And anytime you get two or more people together, you're going to have different personalities. You're going to have egos. You're going to have people that have their own agendas, or that, you know, they want to put their own spin on things, or they're in it for a different reason. And so I'm much more of a solo person, or maybe one or two other people. And, you know, not that there's anything wrong with being in a group. And if you've got especially a large group, you need a leader. You need somebody to guide you and stuff. But again, you know, as long as their motives are clear, I don't have a problem with it. But some of the, particularly in the UFO communities and as of late in the Bigfoot communities, it gets to be so toxic. I've just had to step away from it. And that's nothing personal against any particular person or another, but I know a lot of people that have had that kind of experience with it. And that's sad, really. But again, you have all these groups now and you have all these people out there. So I'm glad to see it happening. For whatever reason or motive, it's just, some of it's just not for me.
Yeah. I've had a few, encounters, you know, within the communities that I would say, you know, like some people, you know, who I've been very supportive of have turned out to be, you know, real grade A creeps. And you know, the more I get to know them, the more I realize that they have some sort of behavioral disorder. And I guess this type of field attracts all types. But, you know, at the same time, we still have to conduct ourselves. You know, we still have to be grown-ups about it.
It does. And when you walk along the fringe like that, there's some strange people on the fringe in anything, I think. But when you get into the fringe science and things like this, I think it especially brings out people that are very different, shall we say.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, there's nothing wrong with being different and stuff. But you still gotta be able to conduct yourself. You still gotta be able to put a lid on it. Because when it gets to the point that you're like making the environment, you know, just confrontational for others, then it's like, no, you're not quirky. You're just annoying.
Yeah. Cisco and I have talked about that, how a lot of these groups, there's infighting, there's, you know, jealousies and just a lot of pettiness, you know, that, and then you have people that, you know, and I understand people do things different ways, but like the people that provoke and do things like that, that just kind of turns me off. I mean, if I'm in a location that's actively haunted and there's a ghost or something there, I tend to feel sorry for it more than to try to anger it just to get a reaction for, you know, my YouTube channel or whatever. That's, to me, that's just the wrong way to go about things. But again, that's just me. Now, Cisco, she has a different tact altogether. She's more of an empath, more of a spiritual side of it. She will try to cross entities or spirits over into the next realm. And that's beyond my pay grade. I don't know about that. Don't know how to do that, but I know she's into that and know some of her contemporaries that claim to have had success with it. And who am I to say whether it works or it doesn't? If they think that's what happens and then the ghost is no longer there, the property is no longer active, well, there you go.
So you don't do any astral projection or have any psychic powers or anything of your own, do you?
No, not really. I'm a bit empathic. I used to read tarot cards and do things like that. My grandmother on my mother's side was a self-proclaimed gypsy witch, and she told fortunes. She read tea leaves, coffee grounds, animal entrails, and practiced phrenology, which she could tell things about you by the bumps on your head. It was very popular around the turn of the last century, and their family was a part of that whole spiritualism movement from the late 1800s and early 1900s. And they used Ouija board. They held seances. They did table tipping, things like that. So I came by it honestly, but it's still weird kind of to stand outside and look back into that. And I've got – it's probably more just an intuitiveness and a way to read people. But I can do that. But it's not – I mean, I don't claim to have any psychic powers or anything. Now, that's according to my grandma. I was marked as a special child. I was born with, they call it having a veil over your face or having a caul over your face. And all it is, it's part of the afterbirth. When you're born, it's over your head and they remove it. But she was very superstitious from the hills and hollers of Appalachia. And in her eyes, that marked me as a special child. So she would tell me all these things, you know, and tell me what to look for and how to do this and how to do that. So as far as any fortune telling or divination or anything like that, I learned all that from her. And the only thing I've really had great success with is pendulum dowsing. I can do that fairly well. And then water dowsing with a willow branch. I can find water. And I get that from both sides. My dad was also, he called himself a water witch. He could find things with a forked branch.
Yeah. I mean, what in most of the whenever I talk to people who usually have claim, you know, psychic powers, it usually like sometimes their proof is usually involved of proving to someone that they can read minds or do whatever. It usually involves some, I guess, gross invasion of privacy on the other person. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, there has to be some way to be able to showcase, you know, psychic ability without violating someone's, the sense of someone's privacy like that, you know, without being able to tell them how many pairs of pink underwear they have in their drawer or anything like that.
Yeah. I see some of these guys on TV and I'm just like, man, that's a, it looks like a sham. It looks like they're just making stuff up because it's kind of a scattergun approach. You know, does anybody know a person whose name starts with an A? And then the people will try to make that fit. Oh, I have a sister named Anne. You know, that's they're just throwing stuff out there and then people are connecting the dots and then they leave thinking, wow, that guy told me about my sister Anne, but he really didn't. You told him about your sister Anne and he repeated back to you. So there's little parlor tricks and things to watch for there. I did stage magic at one time. I used to put on shows for kids' birthday parties and stuff like that. And there, within that realm of performance, there are entire books on how to do little things like that, how to do a cold reading and how to gather information and read body language and what to look for, you know, just in people to tell them about themselves and amaze them. But it's really more psychology than being psychic.
Yeah. With the cold reading stuff like that, I mean, it is a skill, but even in the cold reading and stuff, there is something to the intuition part. I think it was a 60 Minutes news story where they tested a bunch of people at the university on their psychic abilities, you know, with just yes or no questions. And one of the people being tested was, I believe it was John Edwards. And even though he's been, you know, outed as a sham, he came out with, he tested like better than most of the other people, so whatever it was, you know, he was more proficient at it.
Yeah, he had that to a degree. And that's true. I've met people that would do like the Zener cards and could get them, you know, just 80% or better. And I saw a lady one time, and she was actually going two cards ahead. She missed every one, but then when they looked at the results afterwards, she was one ahead. Like the card that she said it would be, it wasn't it when they turned it over, but the next one was, and she had like almost 100%, but one ahead. So, you know, there's all kinds of factors in there, but that's fascinating to me. The extrasensory stuff, that was big when I was a kid back in the 70s, you know, In Search Of, and some of those shows had like Peter Hercos, who did the photography, you know, where he could imagine a scene and imprint it on Polaroid film. And he had Uri Geller and the amazing Kreskin, who did a lot of mind tricks like that and things. It's fascinating stuff. And again, I think there is a bit of truth. There's a bit of science in there. It may be an area of science that we don't understand or don't fully know or recognize. But I believe there is an intuitiveness that's built into people. And it's just, you know, that gut reaction, that gut feeling. It's learning how to listen to that and how to discern, you know, that's my imagination, or I really am picking up something off this. Because I've had that happen, you know. Any empathy or anything I have is like if I go into a place, say a hospital or a nursing home or somewhere like that, particularly a children's hospital, I can't stay. I feel like I'm picking up everything from everybody in there, and it just feels like it drains you. Mm-hmm. And the same when I used to read tarot cards. There were, now not every time, but there were times when I didn't need the cards. So when the moment the person walked through the door, I knew what they were going to ask me. I knew what the answer was. But I felt silly just sitting there going, well, you know, this, and this. But then when I would do the card spread, the same thing would come out in the cards. And that was, say, a concrete tool to explain an abstract concept. If you're just telling them, it's one thing, but if you're reading it in the cards, that gives them something even more firm to believe in. But I had that happen lots of times. Not every time, but a lot of times I would know, and then the cards would show the same thing. Now, how's that work? I don't know. Yeah. it did.
Yeah, I think there is something in general intuition that just manifests in certain ways that is innate in every single person. Mm-hmm. And I do feel like all of us have that definitely have that potential, but like everything else, there's just a way to better, for other people to better channel into that.
Yeah. And I think it had to do with, you know, ages ago, you had to be more intuitive. You had to be more in tune with yourself and with nature and with other people and things like that. And as our world's gotten smaller, through electronics and technology and things, we've lost a lot of those abilities that I think are in humans, but it's when you use it or lose it, I guess, type situations. I mean, nowadays, there are people, I don't even know their phone number because I've got it in my phone. I don't have to look at it. But when I was a kid, you know, I had every number memorized. I can still tell you every home phone number I ever had growing up, but I struggle remembering my number now. Yeah. And I think, even though things have gotten more convenient and have gotten more high tech, and, you know, we've got the world literally in our hands with a cell phone, a smartphone, but we've lost a lot of our humanness. So there's kind of some sort of separation there where we've become part of the machine.
Yeah. We've also sort of lost that connection of from our emotions to our fingertips. There used to be so many different barriers to mm-hmm. express ourselves, and now it's like instantaneous. And I think that is sort of, you know, I think social media sort of grew faster than our emotional maturity to handle it.
Absolutely. I've often wondered about that, if it was just if the anonymity of the internet has made people meaner and more angry, or if it's just, you know, giving them something to hide behind and to be able to express it. And they were always that way, because there's just some of the most hateful people online that I've ever met, you know, is Facebook and groups like that. There's just some nasty people out there, people with bad attitudes and things, and that just seem to thrive on it. You know, that's like a hobby for them, is to go in and stir up trouble or
definitely
bully and brutalize people.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is the tech companies, just my personal conspiracy. You know, they have no problem encouraging it, because every single interaction is one more block of ad space they get to sell.
Yeah, I had somebody tell me that about the YouTube channel, said even if they leave you a thumbs down or they have something negative to say in the comment, that still counts as a view. And that's what the algorithm uses to recommend it to other people who will like it. So you have to take the good with the bad. And that's, you know, I understand that, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I've taken the point that I've tried to personally trying to not post as much political stuff on my Facebook or my
that's my
Instagram.
Career suicide right now. I remain as apolitical as possible. Yeah. And I've pretty much always been that way. But especially, you know, I don't want to alienate my readers. I don't want to alienate my listeners over some opinion of mine that could change. I mean, my opinions change sometimes. So I stay out of all that. Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I don't have an outlet for that. I just take that over to my parlor, and that's a different social media thing that it's sort of
I haven't been on there yet, but it's come highly recommended from some friends of mine here. Yeah.
That's more of a Wild West. So it's sort of like, you know what you're getting. Cause I remember the internet in the heyday during the 90s when it was the Wild West, when you had to know that, you know, the dirty places, the red light districts, or the unsavory dark corners to
they had
go
like
to
the Yahoo chat rooms and AOL. And then I don't know if you remember or not, but there was a thing called IRC, Internet Relay Chat.
Oh yeah. It was basically
citizens band radio of the internet. It was so depending on what server you're on, thousands of channels, every interest under the sun, every perversion under the sun, if that's what you were looking for. And just everybody typing, you know, basically at once. I mean, it would be in just in rows of text, but that really was the Wild West.
Yeah. And I think back then I remember the AOL, the Messenger, and then the MSN when they had their own Messenger unit, and then the ICQ and then there would be people on ICQ that would stream, that would video stream. And that was something. And then people would go on to the video stream, and it was so primitive to what we have now. And it was interesting that all this was being done over a 14K modem that went through the phone line. But it was, and now the only thing that's improved is the bandwidth in which we do it all in, but it's still the same mechanics. And it's just, We're just getting it in a higher resolution now.
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's also opened up a platform for everybody. I mean, there's all those YouTube channels and all the podcasts and things. I was part of like the zine community back in the 80s. I don't know if you remember that or not. Everybody published a little booklet or a little pamphlet of stories or book reviews or whatever you wanted to do. You know, everybody had a voice, and there was one big magazine that aggregated everything called Fact Sheet 5. And I found so many just odd little publishers in there that were just doing it, you know, out of their bedroom or whatever. And now we've got that on a much grander scale. I mean, for example, like with Missing Persons and Mysteries, we started that, Bill did about a year ago, brought me on as narrator. We've got over 50,000 subscribers. You know, I couldn't have done anything like that with a zine. I was lucky to have a dozen subscribers, you know, so it's amazing. It's kind of leveled the playing field, and it's done it not only with that type of entertainment, but music and things like that. You can sit in your bedroom, create music, put it on SoundCloud or, you know, wherever, and reach an audience. There's an audience out there for everything. It's just a matter of finding that audience. And I've heard it referred to as narrow casting or niche casting. But it's amazing. Just anything you're into, within reason, you can find it out there, and that blows my mind.
Yeah, I remember I was mostly interested in comics, and I remember small and independent press, and there were so many hurdles that you had to go through to get, you know, independent publishing and stuff like that. And now it's all literally at your fingertips. I mean, you can produce a comic book and independent stories and even books and novels, you know, at almost basically zero cost with open source assets and resources. And the thing is, you know, yeah, it's widened the availability, but now it's like the curation of it has sort of gone down, that now it's like just because anybody can doesn't mean it's going to be any good.
Doesn't mean they should. Yeah, that's a good example. Amazon, when they first opened up the Kindle desktop publishing, it was flooded. You know, everybody had written a book, and there was a lot of stuff. And even though it might be good or it might have an audience, it was just hard to find. You had to, you know, the signal to noise ratio was so amazing. But I think that's kind of settled down now. There's still a lot of good stuff on there. Still a lot of people self-publishing. That's what I did initially. And like you said, at no cost, I put my book together myself. I made the cover. I formatted it, everything. And I'd sold somewhere around 70,000 copies before I ever went with a traditional publisher. Mm-hmm. So it can be done. I mean, it's just, again, it's finding your niche, finding your audience.
Yeah. Now, your latest book, is that is through the Into the Fray Publishing, is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, I went with those guys out of they're headquartered in Los Angeles, and Beyond the Fray Publishing. And, yeah, they've done a stellar job, and just it's amazing because with that, with getting a publisher, I also got a publicist, I got an agent, I got an editor, and like, you know, wow, this is great. And I've got a couple other books in the works. I'd hope to have them out by this fall, but one's a book of just pure ghost stories, and the other is a book of the myths and legends of the Great Smoky Mountains, an area that's near and dear to my heart. That's where I grew up. But those have been delayed a little bit. I'm still hoping for maybe mid-October, but we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, Into the Fray, they got a really good network. And Shannon, she's good people. I really like her. I remember one time I scheduled, we had made an appointment for her to come on the show, on my show. She had to like reschedule. We couldn't do it. And since then, I've been sort of like tugging at her dress. Shannon. And one time I think she got really, really pissed. What? I'm like, whoa, okay, chill.
Yeah. But that was, she's great. She has a really good show. And she was one of those that sprang forth out of the Bigfoot community. Yeah. I don't remember precisely which group she was involved with, but there was some kind of kerfuffle there, and she ended up going her own way. And now she's, you know, head and shoulders above the group that she left. So I like it when that happens. I'm always for the underdog.
I mean, when she finally like released a book, you know, and stuff like that, I was thinking like, well, it's about damn time, because even on like, when Into the Fray, when she had Ryan and Sam on their show, Ryan Sprague and, Sam Sheraton, when they were doing it like on the regular, they were always nagging her to release a book for like years. Cause I actually went into the backlog.
After too, I was in that crowd. Yeah. We talk a lot. You know, just in real life, we message back and forth and things. I'm always like, Jenna, when are you going to write a book? Because she told some stories. She told her like shadow person encounter one time. The first time she'd ever told that was one of the episodes that I was on her show. And I'm like, you got to write these down. You've got all these stories. And so I'm so glad she finally did it. Her book's doing really well too.
Yeah. I actually illustrated that encounter. not in the book or anything, but I actually did an illustration for the group one time of that encounter of her on her ATV when she saw a shadow man running through the forest.
That was a great story. I'd like to see that. I'll have to look for your illustration.
And then for a while she was like having a publication at her site. And I'm like, you know, and she's like, oh, what am I going to do for a book? It's like, you have all these stories, just board them up and publish them. It's like, you know, I mean, I don't know if I said that to her or if it was Ryan Sprague or someone like that, but it's like, it's one of those things where, you know, I mean, she definitely had the potential and the drive and the networking to get it done. And now that it's out and done, it's fantastic. And she's just doing a stellar job. And it's great to see, you know, people succeed like that. So
yeah. And she's a good person. I've never heard anybody say a bad word about her. I don't know of anybody that, I mean, there may be people out there that I haven't heard of, but she is the nicest, most polite, most cordial person. She's a joy. I can't say enough good things about Shannon.
Yeah. I mean, if any type of headbutting has been, you know, with her that I've ever had has been, you know, over something minor, but it's nothing deal breaking that I would ever have any animosity towards her over. She's like absolutely fantastic. And I hope that I could like finally get her on the show sometime when the stars will be able to align properly. But, you know, cause she's,
I'll see if I can put a bug in her ear and help you out.
Well,
there.
She's one of the big inspirations, one of the many inspirations that got me to start this, because she was having a thing where she would, invite listeners into a group chat and release that as a show. And I would, you know, and that got me more interested in, you know, setting up my own show. So, you know, she's one of the many reasons that this show is, you know, is finally out there is because, you know, I saw her as an example and that she is so, you know, personable and relatable. She doesn't come off as a sort of larger than life monster hunter that goes through the forest and, you know, kills Bigfoot with her bare hands or anything like that. Even though people probably depict her as that in their fan art, but it's just, I'm surprised how, you know, humble she is in that. And, you know, and I really do, appreciate that. Seeing it's nice to see people, you know, especially in this field, because there's
where there are such grand egos and,
because so many times people go, once they get a network show or something like that, they tend to go Hollywood and stuff like that and they become, you know, and I kind of get it, because then they become on everybody's radar. They get a bigger target on their back. So they have to be more guarded in that sense. But in her, I think she's handling herself and the continuing growing success that she's earned very well.
Definitely. And then all these documentaries that she's a part of. I mean, she's really getting out there. I know she works with the Small Town Monsters and some of those guys, and she's doing some on-camera stuff. So, yeah, go Shannon.
Yeah, she needs to do more voice work, though. I like it when
she does just have an incredible voice. And she's got like this it's one of the Blue Yeti microphones, like just a little inexpensive USB microphone. And she did, I don't know if she still does not, she records in a closet in her home. And it sounds like she's in a studio with $1,000 microphone. She's got that voice, and I love to listen to her.
I remember on one of her shows griping about the microphones and the brands and the qualities and stuff like that. It is pretty, cause I was kind of giving her grief over it's like, oh, there's like a much cheaper, just as well alternative out there, you know, but that's just tech head stuff. But I will say this much. Now let's go ahead and tell me a little bit about these Shadow Man encounters and the Shimmer Man encounters and stuff that tend to fall into your lap. If we can probably just segue and get into that for a bit, cause those type of encounters and stuff, I always find particularly fascinating. If we can maybe get into there for a bit, if you mind. If you
sure. The way all that started, I mean, I was familiar with it, had a working knowledge of it. And on the Missing Persons and Mysteries channel, so the focus there is missing persons. But it's one of those things where you deal with those cases all the time, and you're reading and researching, and you know, these people never found, and no closure for their family, what happened to them. It's just so sad. It really, really tugs at you after a while, and you have to kind of step back and do something else. Mm-hmm. So we thought, well, the mysteries part of it, we'll look at some paranormal things.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to sort of like a looking healthy distraction.
Yeah. Just encounters that people had in the woods and in national parks and state parks and things. So it kind of still follows along with a loose theme
heavy all the time.
And once mentioned, you know, a shadow person or a hat man or things, then it turns out that a lot of people, surprisingly, have had those encounters. And it kind of opened the floodgates. Now we get all these emails of people that, you know, I've never told this to anybody, or only my husband or wife knows about this, or, you know, that reminds me of something that happened to me years ago. And we're getting all these stories. Shadow people, those are mainly seen in people's homes. It's some sort of, most people tell you it's a malevolent entity, that it has an evil feel about it. Although I have had a couple of stories where it wasn't evil at all, and it was kind of nice. Mm. So again, maybe that's just perception, or there's different shadow people. And then the Hat Man, that's just what it sounds like. It's a figure that wears a dark cloak and a black hat of some sort. Some cases the brim will be pulled down over the face so that you can't really see what they look like. But though, again, those are seen mainly in homes, although I have heard reports of them being seen outside, you know, in people's yards and in the woods. Hmm. And again, some sort of strange entity that one seems to come along with sleep paralysis. And I've heard it conjectured that maybe that kind of bleeds over into alien abduction in that realm, and it's some sort of screen memory. Hmm. You know, like Whitley Strieber has his owls, maybe some people see the Hat Man instead of a gray or a reptilian or whatever. In that regard, again, I don't have any answers, but I've got lots of good stories and love reading those accounts. And then one that's been popping up a lot recently is a translucent humanoid. I've heard it called the Glimmer Man. I've heard it called the Predator creature. And it's like in the movie Predator. Mainly seen in the woods, but you can see through it, but you can see the outline of it. It kind of, I've heard described as like looking through saran wrap, or like a figure, but that has a human shape, but it looks like the waves of heat rising off a pavement in the summertime.
I've heard like a few sporadic encounters every once in a while, but lately there's been somewhat of a resurgence where it's really become prominent and pushed to the forefront. I think one of the shows that I listen to that they have frequent stories come in is Expanded Perspectives, that they get a lot of good, what they call Glimmer Man stories. And mm-hmm. And it's a lot of the ones where it's like out in the woods and stuff like that, those I find particularly fascinating, because, you know, you would expect to see like a Bigfoot or some other type of outdoorsy cryptid. But rather than that, it's sort of this Glimmer Man pops up instead. There aren't that many, you know, up close face-to-face encounters or interactions. It's just sort of like a passive presence that, from what I've heard so far.
Well, and again, like with the black-eyed kids, I had an encounter with one. Mine wasn't in the woods, but in downtown Portland a couple years ago. I'd been to an event at Powell's Books, which is one of the world's largest bookstores, if not the largest. Thing takes up a couple of city blocks and has many levels. A book lover's dream. But I'd been to some event there and was just making my way back home, not in any particular hurry. And where I had to go to catch they call it the night train. It's the orange line that the Max Transit there that ran to my neighborhood where I was living at the time. And it was getting close to midnight. And I'm waiting at this stop on the transit mall there downtown, and there was nobody else there. And I'm just kind of walking along, looking in the shop windows. Everything was closed. And I noticed over by the street, and it was on the side or on the concrete. It wasn't really a sidewalk out there at that part. But there was a signpost there and a garbage can.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there, between those two, there I noticed there's something. It looked humanoid in nature. It was short stature, maybe 4 feet tall. But it was kind of that whole shimmer thing. And I'm looking, I'm thinking, was there a vent or something here where I'm seeing the heat coming out of something underground? I kind of looked around. There's not anything there. It's just concrete. And it was almost like when it noticed that I was looking at it, it squatted down, like hunched down. Again, it was one of those instances where, you know, the hair stood up and I thought, you know, I need to get out of here. Hmm. So I casually walked up, you know, just dawdling around, you know, acting like I'm not paying any attention. And when I got to the side street there at the corner, which was just, I had to pass by the thing, whatever it was. And there was a car coming, and I purposely stepped out into the street against the light. The car slammed on its brakes, honked at me, and I ran out of the way of the car, feigning, you know, that to get away from whatever this being was. And I just kept running up the block to the next train stop, and thankfully there were people at that one, but that was weird. I don't take the late train home anymore. I don't live in that neighborhood, but even if I did, I'd take Uber or Lyft or something. Again, I can't explain it, but I saw it, and it was just like what other people had described. Now, I've heard that that's some kind of technology that the military and maybe even the police have, that some sort of cloaking technology. I don't know, but I mean, I assume it's possible. Robert Guffey has written an excellent book about that called Camellio, based on some experiences that happened to a guy in San Diego with some sort of military black ops type cloaking technology. Mm. And I think it exists. But then again, it could be some sort of entity that we're not aware of, some sort of alien presence with their technology. And the most interesting one I've heard recently, and this is in the latest subscriber video that I put up on missing persons and mysteries, mm-hmm. had a lady who encountered this type of creature, but it was in the outline of a deer.
Hmm.
So it was like a buck with several point antlers. Now that's the first. I've never heard of any animal described as a glimmer animal. So maybe animals have the technology too, or it's able to shape shift. That was interesting. That's the first animal report that I've heard of a shimmer being.
From what I've heard, most of the encounters or the researchers and everybody likes to attribute it to a human, to like it's a person. But from what the behavior sounds like, completely unpersonable, or like that is not how natural people act. From what I've heard of the behaviors of it, you know, it sounds more like it's some sort of, it does sound completely alien or some sort of non-human entity, you know, even though
a lot of the sightings have been in trees or seen it going from tree to tree. No, unless there's more technology included with that, that's not something that humans have the ability to do, even if they are cloaked. I don't think they can jump from tree to tree the way I've heard this thing described.
Yeah, and it's just how it'll like sneak away or squat or do something like that. You know, that's just like even, you know, it's just not, it just, whatever it is, it doesn't human very well, so to speak. It, cause that's like, even then, you know, if it was, you know, I don't know if people say that because they're like projecting, they're personifying it somehow, like, projecting like what they would think would be human attributes to it, but it just sounds from just behavioral, just purely behavioral, sounds completely more like a sort of like a stalking predator or fleeing prey instinct rather than anything behavioral that I would attribute to a natural born civilized human being, because we have our way of walking and doing stuff and that, you know, no speech has ever that I know of has been attributed to people, anyone even having a conversation with it, unless it involves some sort of psychic something, which would take it into another realm.
kind of constant, and it's not been in all cases, but a lot of people report a clicking sound, which that kind of lends theory to that it's something electronic, that it's making a noise, you know, this cloaking device or whatever, but who knows? And I don't think I've ever heard of anybody actually being physically attacked. I've heard of people being stalked, being followed by it, and getting away from it, but I don't think I've ever heard of an encounter with anybody that actually physically interacted with one, you know, as far as getting hit or grabbed or anything like that. Now, that would take things to a whole nother level.
I wonder if the clicking is attributed, if people just, maybe they think they hear that, or if that's, because that sounds like something from the movie Predator. I don't know if that's because if that's what they saw, then they would expect it to make that noise. I don't know if that's like a projection or
interesting. If it's like just a hive mind type thing that, oh, it's supposed to do this. So I think I heard it, whether I did or not. But it's interesting. And there's people that I've talked to, though, that have encountered these that have never seen the movie Predator. I mean, I'm sure they're aware of it, but I don't think I've ever watched it. But I know, you know, the premise, the basic plot, and how the creature has a cloaking ability. Yeah. But it's one of those things, like, almost like there's some sort of cosmic trickster out there that tries things but can't quite get it right. Like, start out, you have like the Men in Black. Yeah. Well, you know, they wear nice suits, they drive nice cars. You know, surely people won't be bothered by them. But then just through their mannerisms and their speech and whatnot, people are weirded out.
Yeah.
And then along comes, you know, say the black-eyed kids. Oh, well, it's kids. You know, everybody loves kids, but they're weird little kids that dress strange and have coal for eyes, you know. And then you have the phantom clowns. Oh, everybody loves clowns. We'll send clowns out there. But they're weird clowns that chase people in the woods. And, you know, I've been hearing reports lately of black-eyed adults. And I started thinking about that because some of the first black-eyed children reports in modern age, anyway, were back in the 90s. Well, if they were kids then, they're probably going to be in their 30s or so now. So are the black-eyed adults that people are now reporting, are those black-eyed kids that have grown up? Yeah. Or is it a whole new species of the entity? It's the mind boggles. There's so many different ways you can think about this stuff, and there are no answers. And like Charles Fort said, one measures a circle beginning anywhere. So there you go. It's all fascinating to me.
Yeah, I'll say this much. The phenomenon, whatever it is, however it manifests itself, it seems like our pop culture infects it. Like with the Predator type of, or the Glimmer Man type of stuff, and then the Shadow Man, and then the Hat Man. Even though there's been accounts of it always being there, always being present, and I think that I attribute that to the rise of the internet. I have this theory that you know, like all these weird stories, they've always been there. It's just they get shaken loose by this sort of the sort of potpourri of paranormal accounts and stuff like that, that these stuff has always been. And the reason that these stories come in waves is because one story shakes a bunch of other accounts loose that have sort of, you know, always been there. Yeah. But it's this sort of thing where I do think maybe there is an element of, you know, of our pop culture premise preloading our expectations of what it is whenever it decides to enter into our realm.
That's a perfect theory. And I think a lot of times you have like local variations that kind of add in and stuff too, because if you look at some of the typical urban legends, you know, the vanishing hitchhiker or the crybaby bridge and all that, I can't tell you how many little towns, communities I've been to that have a crybaby bridge. Mm-hmm. And surely not in every one of those did a woman go crazy and throw her baby off the bridge. But I think it happened somewhere, that there is, you know, an impetus. There is a nugget of truth in there somewhere. It really did happen. But then the story got passed down, and maybe the person that heard it didn't hear where it was from, so they just gave it a local place. And then, well, a bridge must have been this bridge, and then that's how it got started. But there's something in there, though, you know, just the way those stories travel and those legends travel. Like, my dad was from a tiny little area in Fentress County in Middle Tennessee, and my mom was from the Cades Cove area, the Smokies, and my parents were I was a late in life baby. My parents were the age of most of my friends' grandparents. My dad was born in 21. My mom was born in 27. But yet, after they met each other working on the Manhattan Project in Oak Ridge during the war, but after they got together, they compared stories, and they had heard a lot of the same stories growing up, the same legends and myths and things, but it was localized. Like, my dad would hear about the Cumberland Plateau, my mom would hear about the Smokies, but it was the same story, just the location had changed. And you wonder how that happens, if it's almost like, you know, the telephone game that you used to play in school when you're a kid, where one person starts it out and whispers it to the next, and by the time you get to the end, it's something else entirely. I think it's something like that, maybe. But that's the part to me that's fascinating about collecting folklore and things, is hearing the little variations and the local flavor and color that gets added to some of the stories.
Yeah, and it seems like in every single town has a story about an escaped, a sane inmate from the insane asylum in the next town over. You know, it's yeah, that is an interesting thing. Let's go ahead and let's go back, and then we'll wrap it up there. Is let's talk a little bit more about the Black Eyed Kid phenomena. Let's go ahead and just speculate a little bit about that. What is your, from what you've heard so far, from what research you've had, what do you think is going on in relation to that particular phenomena?
Well, it's kind of hard to say, and there's so many different schools of thought there. There are people that believe that it's some sort of alien being, that some sort of, you know, extraterrestrial, or at least from another dimension, which, you know, that if you believe along those lines, that makes sense. And then I've heard people say that they're demonic, that there's something, you know, some type of a devil or demon inspired thing. And again, that, you know, people with religious beliefs and feelings, that's the kind of spin they put on it. But I'm kind of right in the middle there. I don't necessarily think that they're demonic, but I don't know that they're entirely from another dimension, or however you want to, that they're, you know, some sort of race that's been sent here to try to infiltrate or studies. But the thing that always fascinated me about it was the parallel between the Black Eyed Kids and the traditional vampires, say, of Europe.
Yeah.
Where they have to have your permission. They have to be let in. You know, they can't just come in, or they can't. In my case, they couldn't get in my car. I had to invite them into my car. And it's kind of the same when you hear different versions of it. It's the same thing. You know, there was a knock at the door. They wanted to be let in. And one of the first encounters I ever heard of was a guy that was outside a movie theater, and some kids came up to him and wanted him to give him a ride somewhere or something like that.
Yeah, I remember that encounter.
I don't remember the exact details. But again, it's, they couldn't, you know, they didn't try to just get in. They had to have permission. And I'm waiting for the person that lets them in. And I'm thinking maybe there has been, and we never hear that. That's, you know, that's the kind of scary part. There was one lady that I heard of that had let them in. And then I think her husband died, and she got some rare form of cancer.
I've heard of that account. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and after they let them in, they had – like effects of radiation poisoning and things like that, conjunctivitis in their eyes and sore throats and things. And I'm like, you know, what on earth? So that almost, that points back to kind of a UFO alien type scenario, because I know some of the witness accounts that I read back in the 70s and things, people that saw craft would experience that with the Flatwoods Monster. You know, there was an odor that burned their noses and throats that persisted. There's people that had the effects of, like, they've been exposed to radiation, and there'd also be things left in the area on the ground and things that would tick off on a Geiger counter.
Yeah.
So there's something out there. There's too many people that have had too many encounters for it not to be something. Yeah, I know that's pretty vague, but.
Yeah, I kind of wonder what that is, if it's like where's that radiation? Because I have a hard time believing that all these, you know, things are walking around, you know, that they have nuclear powered batteries in their backs or anything like that. Or maybe if that's just fallout from one dimension belching into another.
That's kind of the theory that I've heard, and it makes the most sense from that perspective. It's, you know, when there's a rip in the continuum there's other stuff that comes through, and that would kind of stand to reason, you know, if you look into some of the quantum physics and things like that about how energy is released, you know, say from a black hole or something like that, then there's going to be fallout. There's going to be something, some kind of residue left behind.
Maybe that's why we saw an uptick in alien encounters when we started testing atomic weapons. You know, we were probably farting in someone's yard.
Jack Parsons, who was among other things, he was a contemporary of L. Ron Hubbard and Aleister Crowley, and he also worked in the Jet Propulsion Lab at NASA. Just a brilliant, brilliant scientist. And this person put it to me like, you think about that. They have the Trinity tests out in the desert where they set off these nuclear explosions. The next year was when Kenneth Arnold had the first modern UFO saucer sighting up here in Washington State. Mm-hmm. So they're saying that through this magical working that they were also doing at the same time, that's magic with a K, because he was a member of the OTO and some of those type religions, alternate religions, that maybe part of that was they created some kind of rip in the fabric, if you were, and things came through. Hmm. But then, you know, you have UFO sightings and things that predates all that by centuries. But I think the modern UFO, that kind of makes sense. Modern UFO flaps began shortly after the Trinity test and whatever working that he was doing out in the desert in conjunction with that. And then he ended up blowing himself up with fulminate of mercury. He also did special effects for the movies, but then there's people within the magical community that conjecture, no, he was doing some sort of black magic working that went horribly wrong, and that's why things blew up. So who knows, but it's an interesting story nonetheless.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One thing that I also think is with the BEKs is, you know, sometimes one of my personal theories is, or speculations is that, you know, what we're seeing is just an extension. What we can see as far as the children, that those are just a lure, like an angler fish. That's the bright light that is supposed to entice us. And it's just, you know, there's something more sinister and, you know, off in the distance, just inching closer as it uses this sort of lure to lull us into a false sense of security. But of course, because it's not perfect, it's something's off. It doesn't always work.
And that kind of goes back to what I was talking about, like with the men in black too. Mm-hmm. You know, they appeared somewhat normal, but they had strange mannerisms or strange speech, or some people encountered ones that they could see wires coming out of their pant leg and things like that. So there's something that we're used to and something that we would accept, but they didn't quite get it right in whatever they were using to make it or duplicate it.
Yeah, didn't pass the uncanny valley.
Joking with Soraya one time on his show that if they ever send black-eyed bikini models with pizza and metal albums, I'm probably a goner. If somebody shows up at my door with pizza and music, I'm going to let them in.
Yeah, I mean, that is something absolutely strange. And what I find fascinating is, you know, I'm supposedly the BEK phenomena has gone all the way back to like 1800s, I believe, that there were some recorded encounters. But at the time, they didn't know what to categorize it in. And that's another thing, too, is all these stories that are shaken loose, they now have a category, or at least some place that they can go before it's like, well, this is too strange for whatever, because in the early days of print, when print was king, when everything was physical media, you know, Bigfoot and UFOs would dominate everything because those were the biggest sellers and all the books they had to sell stuff. Anything else that was miscellaneous paranormal, there probably wasn't enough of it to sell a book, or the publishers probably decided, you know, we can't do anything with this. It's too strange. And now with the outlet of a more open-ended publication and content creation and content consumption, that more miscellaneous stuff is now finding a place. And some of it, you know, grows strength and goes completely wild, like the Black Eyed Kids or the Dogmans. And some
Dog
of it,
Man, yeah,
just,
I was just going to mention that. That's gone wild recently. Yeah. And that was one, if you look at it, I think it just kind of was reclassified. If you look at some of the classic werewolf stories from earlier centuries here and in Europe, it's kind of the same thing, but now it's Dogman instead of a werewolf.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Dogman encounters and stuff like that. There's so much there. And
winged humanoids. Yeah. Can't forget those. I mean, you have the Mothman, but then there's more that have been seen. There's been some seen recently. Ron Strickler that does, Arcane Radio, Phantom and Monsters. He's always getting these reports of winged creatures, winged humanoids, and they're around Chicago, different places in Pennsylvania. And you know what on earth is that? I mean, I'm familiar with the Mothman, but now they're seeing it in lots of different places. Is that mean there's more tragedies coming? Is it the same Mothman? Are there more of them? What, you know, I'm keeping an eye on that.
Yeah, he does have quite a bit of fascinating accounts coming his way. So that is something I find very interesting.
And Dark Waters on YouTube, he's like the king of the Dogman stories. He gets a lot of Dogman encounters, and he actually goes out and investigates them where he can. He's down in Louisiana, and apparently it's just rife with Dogman encounters down there.
Yeah, I've heard quite a lot of him on other shows. Quite fascinating. I do love like the Dogman stories out there. It's one of those I can never get enough of, but then at the same time, you know, I'm looking more for the more miscellaneous encounters because so much of the, you know, cause you can I can only handle so many, you know, I saw something and then it ran away or something came up to the car window and intimidated me and then I ran away or something like that. I can only take so many brief encounters.
Looking for a little more meat. It's like, I don't know if you're familiar with Albert Rosales' work, but he has all these strange creature and humanoid encounters that he's cataloged going back decades. And a lot of those are just unclassifiable. I was just thumbing through one of those the other day. There's like a mermaid sighting and things like that. You know, I like the rare ones. Like, I mean, when's the last time you heard of somebody seeing a mermaid? I like those kind of stories.
Yeah, or like a unicorn or something of that nature.
Yeah, dragons or some sort of almost like a griffin or something that's a beast that's put together out of several other things.
Yeah, but, some manner
you know,
of chimera.
You think about that, I think that it could exist. You look at a platypus and how weird that looks. Imagine, you know, the first people to see one of those. You know, what is that? Like, no, you didn't see something that had fur and a duck's beak and claws and a beaver-like tail, you know, but there it is. And sometimes I remind people that there was a time when that the great apes were thought to be just a myth. And back in the last, around the turn of the last century, they thought that was just made up stories and stuff. Yeah. Some of the gorillas and things that they later discovered indeed do exist.
Yeah. And now it's like, we can't imagine our modern world, our modern pop culture, our modern civilization without them. Mm-hmm. When there was a time when everything went on like with absolutely no mention or record or anything of that, as far as we know of them ever existing. And now it's like they're just an integrated part of our society, the great apes, and that they're now just the endless, even to this day, we're just endlessly fascinated with them.
Yep.
Because of, I guess, how much of ourselves that we want to see in them.
Mm-hmm. I've read some really interesting Thunderbird encounters lately. Most of those come out of the Southwest, Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, that area. Some sort of winged dragon-looking thing that's, you know, in the Navajo and Ute culture, it's a thunderbird, but it's what some people recognize as a dragon. So, you know, what is that? And then there's that famous photo of the pterodactyl that the Civil War soldiers took down. I've heard that's a clever fake, but who knows?
Well, I've heard several things. That one, that there is an authentic one, but it's been buried, it's been scraped. But there are so many recreations of it.
And then they faked one and put that out just to discredit the real ones. Oh, no, it's fake.
Yeah, but there are several recreations. and the thing
you have things. What's the fish? I'm probably saying it wrong, but the coelacanth or the calicanth or whatever it's called that was thought to be extinct for thousands and thousands of years, and then they found one in a creek somewhere. So I think there are holdovers from that era that sometimes you have to know where to look.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just such a fascinating world. I guess we'll go ahead and we'll sort of wrap it up right here, because this has been a fantastic conversation. I've
had a great time, Christopher. Yeah. Like talking to an old friend. I'd be happy to come back anytime you'll have me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm very glad that you took the time, and there's so much more that we could talk about, but I just gotta, you know, I can't keep you to myself all day. you gotta go out there and do stuff. And I really enjoy, hearing you on your other shows, and I'm glad that we were finally able to get the time for you to come over here and just, we could like, you know, chew the fat a bit. It's been, you know, cause there's just so much stuff out there, and I'm really glad to be able to talk to you about all this stuff. And it's just
absolutely.
Like my much fascinating thing. So go ahead and give us, like what you got coming up and where we can find it and where you recommend go with it. We go to, check out some of your best stuff.
Okay. Well, again, we mentioned my personal channel, 13 Past Midnight. That's basically me narrating stories from my books and a few other things in there. And then I do the work on missing persons and mysteries. That's everything from missing 411 type fare to cryptids, and really getting into the some of the paranormal stuff now with the subscribers have been sending us in all these stories of Hat Man and Shadow People and Glimmer Man and things like that. There's a lot of action going on there. My books, the first two combined into one, Strange Things in the Woods, and my personal encounters in My Strange World. Those are available on Amazon in ebook, paperback, and audiobook. And I think they're also available on Barnes & Noble and wherever fine books are sold. My publisher told me to say that. And I'm on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @strangeandodd, all spelled out. And you can find me on Facebook, Steve Stockton, and the number is 81, Steve Stockton 81. And that's also my address at Gmail. I love to hear from people. SteveStockton81@gmail.com.
All right. Well, and again, thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
We'll definitely talk to you again. Thank you.